Hello and welcome to episode 16 of the Universe podcast. I'm your host Leo, here with my co-host Charlotte.
Hello.
And our guest Andy.
Hello.
Hello everybody. Andy, this is your first time on the podcast, right?
Correct.
Would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. My name is Andy and I study English and History at the University of Vienna to be a teacher. But I'm also interested in the sort of linguistics and literature aspect of English. And after sort of coming into contact with your Universe group, I'm now very interested in writing myself, not just reading writing from other people.
Great, nice to have you here. We're going to start with the reading.
Mountain Impasse. Look, boy, when the wind howls, you can see the shadows walk, Clever Jack said. Don't let them snatch you and drag you away, unless you want your little ass to fall off in the cold. All Tommy could see was whiteness. Now and again, he thought there was a rock, or maybe a tree, but the air was so thick with snow that he could never be certain of anything but a storm. There aren't any shadows, he complained. Better not look too hard, or they might just look straight back at you. They can smell your fear, don't you know? Are you having me on? Is he having me on? Clever Jack shouldn't lie to them, Tommy thought. If Clever Jack lied, then how was Tommy supposed to know what was real and what wasn't? He turned to the others, but Slick and Beryl only laughed. Among the three of them, Clever Jack had a reputation of being the intellectual. As far as Tommy could tell, this was because he had once killed the owner of a bookstore and spent the better part of a week trying to make a profit by selling his wares to clerics and scholars. Is the little boy afraid of the weather? Beryl patted his stomach as he laughed. Even some blind man could see how Beryl had gotten his nickname. I'm almost a man, Tommy squeaked. You think everyone's small because you're too fat to see your feet sitting down. He punched Beryl's gut, to no effect. What's that, little mouse? I think we've got a pest problem, guys. He kicked Tommy over with a heavy leather boot, and the three men were still laughing when the boy jumped back up and began to rub his backside. He left the sellswords to guard the entrance and retreated further into the cave. As soon as he turned, he noticed a pair of eyes. What are you looking at? Tommy demanded. The observer was set in between the priest and the merchant. He'd been with the merchant even before the Selzords were hired on, and he rarely spoke. Tommy hated his face. They had taken to referring to him as Adonis, and his was the most hideous face Tommy had ever seen. The man's mouth was a crooked gash, his nose broken in at least three places, bent down and then strangely off to the side, and one of his eyes only ever seemed to half open. Enemy blades and some unfortunate childhood outbreak of the pox had left deep, jagged scars and craters all across his face and scalp. He had no hair on his head, but a coal black beard sprouted randomly from small patches, creating a chaotic pattern of sickly pale skin shining from beneath the coarse, dark tangles. He stared at Tommy across the campfire, and his obsidian eyes gleamed in the flickering light. Hey, I'm talking to you. Adonis said nothing. You mustn't be rude to your elders, young one, the ancient priest answered instead. Have these guardians of yours been teaching you no manners? Manners are for women and cravens, Tommy sat down by the fire and tapped the hilt of his dagger meaningfully. This is all the courtesy a man needs. And scene.
I really like the voices you do when you read your texts.
They quite frequently change from when I start reading the text to when I get further along.
Yeah, but I think today you really did it was really like kind of good through line.
Thank you.
I guess it's also just normal for them to change. I mean, you kind of settle into the characters as you read them.
Yeah. It's just hard to remember.
Yeah, that too, I guess.
Especially if you come back to one you did previously.
Mm-hmm. Is this the beginning of a larger story?
Yeah, so far I've around 5,000 words and haven't managed to get to the ending quite, so I think I have to trim a bit. Because I like sort of short stories to be a bit shorter than that.
Mm-hmm. What's your usual average goal that you go for?
It sort of just happened that I usually went around 3,000.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of like that because it's very easy for a short story to drag, I feel, when reading them myself. So I like a slightly brisker pace.
That's how many pages? 3,000 words? Around 10?
This is around 500 words with no spaces. So with no line breaks.
Paragraph,
yeah. And it is about 3/4 of a page.
What font size?
12 and Times New Roman thing, standard thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not quite finished yet?
No, it's not quite finished yet.
But you know where it's going.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really important because when you ask me to bring a sort of introduction or beginning
mm-hmm.
for this podcast, I thought that was quite cool because that's something I think about a lot. So I usually need to know at least sort of a direction the ending is supposed to go because otherwise I can't. I usually try to sort of have the beginning few sentences encapsulate the whole story in some way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then that doesn't work that's the second to last thing I do after just before the actual ending.
Okay. You don't have that here yet.
The actual ending?
Yeah, the first couple of sentences.
Yeah, I do, sort of. Unless I change the ending.
Oh, yeah, the shadows in the outside.
Yes, I can't really show you now, but yeah, so he tells him that you can see the shadows walk, and mm-hmm. it's both a sort of character introduction for the character of Clever Jack messing with the little boy. The little boy, like, forming his worldview from the nonsense a few very irresponsible adults tell him.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of the idea that you are afraid of things that aren't really there. It's just shadows. Mm-hmm. But he still says.
Okay, yeah.
So I like that a lot in, like, sort of taking a long time to come up with beginnings. Mm-hmm. Which is why a lot of my starting sentences in stories are long and torturous. Because I just want to put a lot in it.
Oh, yeah.
Which might have to change. I don't know.
Okay, but it's a cool kind of style element.
It's very common, I think. It's definitely something that has a lot written about it.
Okay.
This sort of idea that you have it's like academic writing where you start with a thesis statement, and that is, like, if you read the 7 basic stories or any of those works about storytelling, then that's often recommended in some way. And I think it is elegant, but definitely not necessary.
Do you read a lot about, like, works about writing?
Yeah.
I've never read something like that.
I have. Some of them are really good, and others are a bit bland, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one by, what's his name, David Foster Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a small book like this. It's just very thin and very small. And he was asked to give a lecture in some American university about creative writing, and he didn't know what to do because he said, I just write, I can't, like, tell you how to write because it's writing.
Mm-hmm.
But then what he did is he gave a lecture, and it's basically philosophy, I guess, but it's really interesting to read. And he also talked a little bit about writing, but then he kind of talked about other things. And then I read one by a German Swiss author who writes about writing. Sometimes it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely people who can write which helps.
Mm-hmm.
Because then it's not completely dull. At least they know how to change up the sentence length to keep it engaging and stuff like that.
And I've read a fair bit on show and don't tell, because I sometimes fall in the trap of telling more than showing. And I think that's a very, very useful concept show your readers something instead of telling them explicitly, like, and now she bursts out into hysterical laughter. I'm like, okay, that's really boring. You could just describe the action without describing the action.
Mm-hmm. Just depict the action instead of telling them.
Her mouth opened wildly while a sound of roaring, I don't know, bells or something came out of it. And she held her her belly and tears poured from her eyes, something like that. I don't know, that's the same thing, just not explicitly described.
Yeah, that's definitely useful.
Yeah.
Do you like often start using a lot of adverbs in your stories and then cut them out one by one and replace them with more useful descriptions?
I sometimes notice that when I, let's say I just wrote a chapter in a story and then I read it again, and then I notice that I do that, and then I, or it's just a sentence like, and then she, or I put on my clothes or something. It's like a really boring sentence that has no, I mean, it does have meaning, but it's kind of, so sometimes we need sentences like these because they kind of are necessary. But whenever I can think of a way to describe it more creatively, I try to do it.
Yeah, or just like put in information that like adds to character building. Like
yeah,
not she put on her clothing, but she put on her ridiculous pink and yellow polka dot, whatever. Now we know what sort of clothing style she has and stuff.
Exactly.
It's really interesting. I wonder if there's something like that for poetry, but I doubt it.
There is definitely nothing like that for poetry.
I even think that there are certain metaphors that have been overused in poetry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So people try to find new ones.
Sure.
I think there must be books about that.
Mm-hmm. The only comparable thing I've read is guides on studying and doing history. Like there's the one by Umberto Eco.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Did you?
I had to have excerpts on Moodle.
Mm-hmm. When you began studying that.
Yeah.
And Lucien Febvre's entry lecture.
Oh,
as the, I don't know, but a Collège de France, I think. Or whatever, where he talks about the program of the annals historiens. So that's the closest thing to writing guides, I guess, that I know.
Yeah, but this is really a different kind of writing now, but if you like look at old historians, they took that as an exercise in storytelling, like Herodotus and the Greek masters of history. They basically did, like, if something was too boring, they just went, well, this should be a lot more exciting. So battle and noble king, and he's incredibly tall and muscular. And
and Thucydides, who was the big idol of the 19th century German historians, who were all about objectivity and doing air quotes here, always put in like actual direct dialogue,
which you can't have
history of the Peloponnesian War. Yeah,
yeah.
he can't have been there. I mean, he was there for part of it because but he can't have been there for every single conversation that he depicted.
But I mean, it's always difficult to give advice because every writer is different and has a different way of writing. I mean, there are writers who have said that the only way they can write is if they set themselves a very strict routine, get up at the same time every day and write for 4 hours straight without getting up, and that's the time they have to write. If they don't do it, then they never get anything done or never get anything finished. And then there are those writers who plan everything out in detail from the very start, and then there are those writers who never plan anything ahead, and then everything develops while they write. So, yeah, I've had discussions with other writers who said, but you're not allowed to write in this and this way because that's not how it's done. And I was like, come on, it's like, it's writing. Everybody has their own way of doing it.
Yeah, fair.
There's no one-size-fits-all solution.
Totally. As long as the outcome is agreed upon.
Yeah.
Well, even if you like the outcome and everyone else doesn't, you can still keep doing what you want. So
totally,
I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe we should get back to your story.
You went very far from the story right now.
Oh, well.
But
you never went far from stories, so that's fine.
Yeah. And I think that's what the podcast is about, in a way.
Yeah.
Both the divulged quite
stories of the universe. Oh, I see. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell us something about the setting of the story? Like, is it set in? How do they get there?
It's incredibly vaguely historical so far.
Mm-hmm.
There is a total of one historical person who shall I can name her. Who might show up? Matilda of Flanders.
Mm-hmm.
And two historical people. So Matilda of Flanders was the wife of William the Conqueror.
Ah.
But she had a previous lover, whom she then, who spurred her and whom she then threw in prison after she got married to the king and had all of the power, and who died there. And this is the, I sort of got the idea to have him try and flee the country when he realizes that the wind is very much not blowing his way anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And now he will be one of those people and possibly captured.
I see.
It's a cool way of being inspired.
Yeah.
It's, as usually when I write historical settings, it is unlikely that it will remain accurate for very long.
Yeah, and also the style you have doesn't sound very historical.
No, the people just talk like I find it easy to understand, usually.
The characters almost a bit remind me, maybe that's probably because it's the only kind of literature, like...
Oh, I think you're right. Let's hear it.
It's a bit pressure-y.
Oh, I see, no. Yeah.
Because there's witty dialogue, there's characters who are kind of, in a way, a bit archetypal, like the what's it called, Barrel?
Yes, an inspired nickname, I know.
Yeah, and also, like, Smart Jack...
Clever Jack,
they're just this, you know, this group of mercenaries. I think this dynamic is kind of, it's quite common also in Pratchett, to me at least.
But I mean, some of it is a little bit, I mean, kind of made me feel like this wasn't necessarily set today.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, one of the last sentences that Tommy says, manners are for women.
This, yeah. But even earlier, I think.
I mean, I mean, of course we know that today there still are people who think that women should behave and stay
silent. Well, Tommy is a bit more pretty progressive than that. He thinks women and cravens, so he's...
Okay, sorry. But yeah, that kind of gave me the feeling that it might be set at a different time. But also it's very, very suitable for today because we, you know, with all that Me Too thing that was going on, it kind of...
I don't usually trust myself to tackle these issues very comprehensively, but I will pay them lip service. Why not?
But I mean, it doesn't have to be covered comprehensively. I think just if it's in there, even a little bit, it already opens conversation, I think.
Hopefully. And hopefully people won't identify with the sort of bigoted characters.
Yeah. How old is Tommy? So he's a boy?
I guess like 13, 14.
And he's already mercenary?
Well, in my head he sort of was adopted by them and is travelling with them. I don't think he does much of the fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hope not.
Maybe, like, I don't think they're very honourable fighters probably, so maybe he like sneaks up behind them and slits people's throats or something like that. But
yikes.
Also not very suitable for kids, I guess.
No
but they I think... Children did sort of have to grow faster in most historical periods that aren't like now, so...
I really like how you set the mood of the characters in this piece, like, even though it's just one A4 page, or not even one entire A4 page, there's Club Jack, Beryl, Tom, the man with the ugly face, the old priest.
Yes, about that.
There's five different, very fleshed out characters. Yeah,
and I think it's even already a bit long, because it will go on to describe the other two I've mentioned, the priest and the merchant as well. So maybe I should sprinkle other things in between there.
Maybe, yeah. I love the passage about the man with the ugly face being called Adonis.
Mm. Oh, yeah, they must.
Because that's such a nice juxtaposition.
It's just being a bit dickish to him, I guess.
Yeah, but still, that's something that people would actually do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I like it.
Do you have any influences for writing? And what do you read commonly? And do you see any influences in this piece?
I guess, well... I do read a lot of Terry Pratchett, which, annoyingly, you already pointed out and found. But I think this is much less comedic than most of his stuff.
At least
it's meant to be. Well, let's see how it turns out. I also, in terms of fantasy, don't usually like the sort of medieval fantasy, but I have read The Song of Ice and Fires and really like them. And, of course, The Lord of the Ringses and The Narnias.
Narniases.
More recently, I prefer the fantasy with a more modern setting, or the urban fantasy is what the kids are calling it, I think. So I really like, well, of course, the Neil Gaiman, who does the absolutely most famous of the urban fantasies to a ridiculous degree, really. But I also like the more comedic ones, like I like Christopher Moore a lot, who sort of just puts incredibly mundane situations and fantasy together, which I like a lot. I really, well, and of course the sort of older comedic British authors like Douglas Adams, and although that isn't sci-fi and fantasy, but P.G. Woodhouse, who inspired him a lot, I think, who is also a comedic writer who wrote about like the Dickensian or Edwardian times, so like I don't remember exactly the times, which is really fun, just sort of comedically, and the language is really fun, like he plays a lot with language stuff like Douglas Adams and Terry Pratchett. And I guess what else in terms of modern fantasy? Oh, I really like Benjamin Croshaw, who also does. Is that not famous? No, probably. I don't think he is. Fair enough.
I've stopped keeping up with the modern fantasy long time ago.
Fair. It's a huge market. He writes like, well, he started off writing a book about his obsession with World of Warcraft called Mogworld, where the characters develop self-awareness. More recently, the NPC characters, the non-player characters in the game develop self-awareness, which I found very fun. And then more recently, just like does the same thing as Christopher Moore does, which is having mundane situations, but look, it's a goblin or a vampire, and it's funny. And I think it is funny. But I don't usually, even though those are the books I read, I usually prefer to try and write more seriously, sort of more earnestly. But yeah. As a few people have mentioned in the universe meetings, a sort of certain amount of base level sass leaks through my earnest intentions usually. So,
have you always been reading a lot of fantasy?
Yeah, pretty much.
And has that inspired you to write early?
Not really, no. I am much more of a reader than a writer. When I was in seventh grade, I think, I did the NaNoWriMo. Do you know what that is?
Yeah,
that
famous.
Yeah, exactly. And wrote a 50,000 word novel, which was, and you see, my motivation wasn't entirely ideal because I finished after exactly word 50,000. So, and this was, I think, a few writers have said, I don't remember who exactly this quote was. But that every writer has like 1,000 terrible stories in them they need to get out. And I think I did a lot with that one because it was just incredibly cliche. It was just incredibly cliche, the hero's journey fantasy story. And so good thing I wrote that now and I don't have to again, I think.
So is that then when you started to write creatively? Was it the first time?
Technically, yeah. But then I didn't continue to do it. Until I read your email around to the anglistics people.
Oh, so you started writing again when you
start number
came,
two. Yeah.
Came to the universe. Yeah, that's interesting.
Which, yeah, so that was really cool for me because I sort of found that I enjoy it now a lot more and it feels a lot less like a chore. Which I think is the NaNoWriMo model a little bit that you have to finish. Which I sort of, yeah.
But I mean, nobody gives you that pressure except yourself. No, there's no, like, if you don't do it, nobody.
But you got, like, notifications to tell you how great you are when you do finish enough words in one day.
I see.
I'm very easily influenced, you.
You get notifications for finishing, like, words? What?
On NaNoWriMo, like, they give you, they like, congratulate you for your progress.
Oh, there's a web page where you go.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I didn't know that. Never tried as I don't write prose.
I would recommend it for people who just struggle to sit down and write, which I don't do anymore, so that's good.
I should probably try it once.
But it's so much. Like, it's 1,600 and something words every day in for 1 month.
That is quite a lot.
It's quite daunting.
Also, especially in November when university starts to get really busy.
Yeah, well, not for me because I'm not studying anymore.
Teachers don't need to work.
Work is starting. Yeah, you're right.
Well, the first couple of years of being a teacher, I don't think they're very leisurely.
Well, then I just write at night and live off coffee during the day. I can do it.
Okay.
Just pick a different one.
I'm interested. Did you ever write creatively in German as well?
After reading your thing, I tried German and English, yeah. Two friends of mine actually writes creatively in German. Mm-hmm. They're in a similar group to you in the German department.
Okay.
Which I sort of tried, and I really like their texts, but when I write in German, I can't shake the sort of sarcastic undertones at all. It's just the sentences are much longer and there's so many unneeded words, just being facetious and showing off with language, and I didn't like that tone much. I used that, so I prefer English, but I did try German. Yeah.
Interesting, very interesting.
And of course, a lot of academic writing is in German and English, so because I do history as well. So that's probably where the tendency comes from to write really wordy sentences, because at university they sort of encourage having long sentences and lots of clauses.
Yeah.
Or maybe not for you, I don't know.
Yeah. I was always encouraged to write short sentences.
Well, maybe you have ridiculously long sentences to start with.
Yes, I do. My German teacher usually kind of scolded me for that, because she said, you're doing yourself nothing good because you're shit at comma placement. So you have to correct the whole sentence every time you miss a comma. And she was so right. At some point I was like, okay, it's 5 lines, 1 sentence, just because of 2 commas that I missed.
Do you find commas really hard now that you have to compare English and German rules? Because I do.
I was never really good at comma placing in German.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm even worse in English.
Oh.
I bet in English, because there's less commas needed, I think.
I think English is a bit easier to
And also, hear. The clauses, when there's a comma needed for a clause, it's just more obvious, I think. Because there's none before that, and then...
We also did more theory in English, probably.
I mean, I probably did lots of theory in middle school for comma placement, but it's been a long time.
Yeah.
But I mean, in English, every native speaker I talk to basically just says, it's just up to you. If you want a comma, put it there. If not, then leave it out. And then I'm like, okay, then I never put a comma anywhere. And then I'm kind of scolded for not having any commas. And I'm like, but you said it was up to me.
It's complex.
Anything else? Yes, I have more questions. That's a kind of a big question, but can you kind of try to say why you write, or why you started again?
Well, I guess sort of being very interested in reading and generally stories. Like, I also really like movies, and I really like analyzing them, reading about how they're made. That just sort of naturally made me want to, like, when I saw what I perceived as a sort of mistake, then the obvious answer is, well, let's see you do it better. And then I thought, yeah, that could be interesting.
Cool.
So, which is why I'm now sort of working in order to try out more fantasy stuff. I'm doing lots of stories about mermaids, which is the sort of testing ground setting I've chosen.
Mm-hmm.
And that a lot of those deal with just issues I have with sort of trends in fantasy, just sort of trying to subvert them.
Okay. What are the trends currently in fantasy? I'm really out of the loop.
I don't actually know about current fantasy a lot.
Okay.
So just when I say currently, I really mean the ones I happen to have read.
Okay.
And I happen to hear about. And it's more so movies than literature, I think.
The last time I was on board with the current trends was when the Aragorn movie books came out.
Okay.
With what's his name? What's his face? The author?
Christopher Paolini.
Paolini, yeah, who never did anything again.
Oh, really? Just
vanished.
Okay.
Did he ever publish anything again?
I have no idea, but...
I mean, he probably is still rich.
Oh, no, I think he did. I actually think he did. I think there's a second book series
by him
that's much less famous.
Uh-huh.
Did you like Eragon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't like the last book as much, but I liked them up to the last book.
Oh, wait, but yeah, I guess it makes sense because you're a few years younger than me, so yeah. You were at the right age probably.
Yes, I was, yeah.
When I read the first one, I found it incredibly boring the whole time until the last chapter. The last chapter was super, super, super exciting. And then I was like, what? Now it's ending? Oh my god. And then I wasn't kind of in the mood to buy it.
Okay.
That is one of the annoying trends. That's there is apparently a lot of fantasy authors feel like they have to have a sort of cliffhanger at the end. And they, in turn, do not feel obligated to in any way finish the story in one book, which of course they shouldn't be, but it's something I think usually prefer. Sort of a complete story and then another complete story, mm-hmm. which is obviously preference, but mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, do you think that's maybe influenced by George R. R. Martin, whose books I also read? Mm-hmm. That's also the only thing I added that read that was with the trend, I guess.
He sort of never, yeah, that's true. He also falls into that category, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Thinking about it, yeah. It's just, I think it's also the market. It's just expected of like a fantasy epic to be at least a trilogy, if not more.
Mm.
Mm.
So fair, but yeah.
I guess that's also really, really, I've heard a lot about Harry Potter, kind of, you know, was the early 2000s, ending of the 90s, and it really set the book market for new fantasy and for kids' literature these days. So everybody else is really going back to Harry Potter and looking at why was Harry Potter this successful and trying to copy it and reverse engineer it and do it again.
Yeah.
It's so interesting because it barely didn't even get published. Like, she sent it out to so many publishing houses and they all turned it down because they said it's too long and too complex for a children's story. And then one of the publishers gave it to his 8-year-old daughter to read and she loved it so much and urged him to publish it. And then he did.
Yeah, it really founded a new trend in publishing. There's this great video by Lindsay Ellis on YouTube. Does a new series for PBS in America on YouTube, and she also talks about how, I think in her video she talks about how the Harry Potter books and the Lord of the Rings movies set the market.
I've seen that, yeah. And she also talks about how Harry Potter paved the way for Lord of the Rings to even be in the cinema.
Yeah.
Because it was an incredibly fantastic story, of course, Harry Potter, but it was still set in the real world, and you had all these links to public schools, which is like incredibly entrenched in the history of Britain's and also British children's stories, because it was at least superficially very similar to Roald Dahl, and the first two movies, because of that, also were very similar to Roald Dahl adaptions. So it was easier to get Harry Potter out, and with that, the sort of our acceptance as a viewing and reading public of fantasy sort of rose, which is really cool.
It's so amazing. Like, I think, as far as I remember, it was Harry Potter in like September and then the first Lord of the Rings movie in December of the same year, which is just ridiculous. Those two big movies of our time that really set, I don't know, that really foundational for me in my childhood, that they came out in the same year, just in months. Within months of each other.
Yeah, it's really weird. What were we talking about?
You see, we always do we go quite far from where we were in the beginning.
I mean, we talked about it already a little bit, but do you have topics or genres that you prefer in general, like to write about? You said at the moment you're focusing on fantasy.
Yeah.
But is there anything else that is interesting to you?
Well, yeah, if I think back on the sort of stories I've written in the last semester, it's very different sort of genres. And that's very much, I'm sort of trying out everything and see what I like best. But I knew from the beginning that I wanted to do fantasy and sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because I've really gotten back into Doctor Who lately. So always trying to do like annoyingly clever time travel things.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and at the beginning I just sort of did young adult stuff, and at the very beginning, so young adult stuff in the sense of just issues that I sort of vaguely remember from being a teenager, and and trying to deal with them, which I just thought was something I technically had some expertise in, what with having been a teenager and spending a lot of time with teenagers, which sounds dodgy, but I am a teacher, so...
oh, yeah.
Is there any topic or genre you would not like to write about?
I haven't done romance yet, and I find it very daunting.
Okay.
But I would also like to try that, so not really, no.
Okay.
Have you ever tried poetry?
Yeah, oh, good point. No, I would like to try poetry.
You would not
like it? I did a comedy poem about a killer robot, and then I just thought it would be so much more expedient if that didn't have to rhyme. And then I stopped.
Poetry doesn't have to rhyme.
Well, but then I don't even know what's the difference between poetry and prose. I know I've checked technically, I'm studying the difference between those things, but I'm not really sure about it anyway.
It's a fluid border.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, also I usually don't have the sort of... I don't think I can make very rhythmic sentences, so that's not something I want to have people focus on when I... All right.
How do you think your teaching, and you do work with youth, right?
Yeah, so at a sort of institute for tutoring and at the youth center.
How do you think that influences your writing?
Well, aside from seeing very different children, because of course the youth center attracts children from economically less fortunate households, and the other institute, which charges a lot for a ridiculous amount for tutoring, attracts people from richer backgrounds. So I can see the problems facing people from the sort of extreme ends, which is quite interesting. So in that, but of course I'm not their buddy. I'm not trying to be their buddy. And so I don't see everything about what they are doing, what they're worrying about and stuff. I think I'm bit closer to their language at least, which helps, but otherwise it's more memories from my own teenage years that help with those stories.
Okay. I mean, yeah, it's you've been through it, so really got the experience.
Even though, of course, it changes a lot. And,
sure.
And I don't think that an adult's memories are very, you can trust them very well when it comes to their own childhood. That's usually always skewed in some way.
That's exactly what exactly be my point, because I think I remember myself as a teenager wrong, to be honest. Because the way I remember myself is not being a real typical teenager at all. I never had any kind of puberty things going on.
Interesting.
I really couldn't say, okay, just because I was a teenager, I know how teenagers are. But then again, I probably remembered it wrong, because back then I probably felt like, oh my God, I don't understand the world, like what's going on? I'm
and now you understand the world, that's cool. You have to explain
totally,
it to me sometime.
Yes, of course. No, but I think now I'm at ease with not understanding it.
Okay.
When you start writing a story, do you ever have the full plot sketched out when you begin?
Well, not when I start, no. Because I usually start just because I think of a fun scene, and then I write that scene, and then I sort of, it then spirals out from there.
Yeah.
So I don't start at the beginning, which is why I can do the beginning once I have thought of the ending, sort of.
But do you know in the beginning where you're going? Do you have an end in mind?
Usually not when I start, well, very vaguely when I start the very first scene, but then it usually goes quite quickly. Now that I have experimented a bit more with fantasy and sci-fi, where there is actual world building required, I have noticed that that is not ideal. So now I need to sort of do a bit of sketches to write what the world will be like, what the characters will be like, what the rules are, if there is anything supernatural involved, what the rules are with that and stuff like that.
Oh, I remember, what was it called? No, you know Patrick Rothfuss of the King Killer Chronicle?
No, I don't think so.
If you haven't read these books, you should read them. They
interesting.
Are the best fantasy I've
ooh.
Probably ever read. They're just so good.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to do a podcast, I don't think he's doing it anymore, with Max Tamkin, the guy, one of the guys who came up with Cards Against Humanity.
Cool.
And they're both just super cool guys, and they used to have a podcast. And some episodes, Pat Rothfuss would talk about the way he writes his books, and it went really in depth. We, you know, he really talked about the rules. So he has like his own money systems, different currencies, and then he talked about how he came up with the currencies and how the currency works and why the currencies are this way. What the currencies tell us about the people.
That's really going above and beyond, but definitely.
I mean, it's like Tolkien inventing whole languages. I mean, Elfish, and that he really didn't need to do that, but he wanted to because,
I think it just gives so much more to a story because it feels much more real.
It definitely makes it easier for the author to make the world feel lived in. It's just he doesn't have to come up with something new every second. He just can draw on something.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Game of Thrones guy, George R. R. Martin, does that as well. And he now has so much of that stuff planned out, so many maps and drawn that were never in the books, that he employs two secretaries who tell him what his world is like. So he's really ridiculously over the top.
Oh, that's great.
So I don't think I would go that far anytime soon. But especially with time travel, I really had to like draw diagrams and find out where.
But it gets complicated.
Yes.
It really does.
Oh, you did a memory story, right?
Yeah.
Was that similarly difficult?
It was tricky sometimes, because...
Like a memory loss story, I mean.
Yeah. It's a shame that none of you could read the whole thing in one go, because...
I only got the ending.
I know. Because what I did actually is that in the first part, there are some... chapters written from one character's point of view and then others from the other character's point of view, and that one character's point of view in the beginning is something that you just read and you think, it's just her thoughts, but later on you realize that's actually her memories that she had, but you don't notice, because you don't know that they lost their memory yet. It's a bit cryptic when I explain now, but it's supposed to be because I don't want to spoil about the story so much. But it was complicated because then I was like, did I already write this? Does this make sense now? Do I have to give more information? Then I had to go back and read, and I was like, this doesn't work.
The good thing is an author can do that, because that sort of contemplation sounds a lot like what the writers of like Doctor Who have to do. But in a TV format, they can't go back and fix what they've messed up in previous episodes. So... Mm-hmm. If you watch every week and just like see the show, that usually makes perfect sense. But then if you go back and rewatch all the episodes, there are lots of mistakes in there.
Really?
Yeah. That's like the whole River Song thing, if you remember that.
Yeah.
It's just it doesn't work out if you play it out.
But that's what's his face?
Moffat
is just not that good a writer.
I think his first season with the 11th Doctor was brilliantly planned out.
I think he's a good writer on a small scale, but not for when he always tries to one-up himself and maybe. Really
I think it's just the medium of TV that he's having trouble with there, because you can't look back and because if you write this sort of stuff, you can just write the ending and then make everything fit in the beginning, but he can't do that. So unless he writes everything before, which he did for the first season of The 11th Doctor, but he didn't then on. Okay. Of course,
I see that's what the problem is.
First of all, I don't think he writes everything. He has other writers who write with him.
But he sort of does the
outside. Yeah, I know, he's in charge of everything. But then I remember that one episode where they had these gas masks and said, "Are you my mommy?"
Oh, it was amazing. That? The empty child and the doctor dances.
And then later on, like 5 or 6 or even 10 episodes later, there was something completely different happening, and then for some reason the doctor finds a gas mask and he puts it on and says, "Are you my mummy?" And it was so hilarious, so they did that. I think it was one of the most hilarious TV moments of my life.
For all of the people who happen to have seen both of those episodes.
Yes, of course. Because you only understand it then. But
I think that was the time when he wasn't the lead writer yet, but he was just writing like single episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, did he do those? The two parts?
I think they did. I watched, I think... It's another YouTube video all over the recommendations again today. I think it's by H Bomber Guy on YouTube, if you know him.
No.
He also talks about like movies and cool culture. And he did an episode that was called, a video that was called Sherlock is Garbage and Here's Why.
That's not confrontational at all.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, he also talks a lot of shit about Moffat. And he also talks about Doctor Who because there he sees the same problems he also sees in Sherlock. And yeah, that's where I get most of my ideas from.
From critics.
Yeah, from the straight critic, because it was it's just so brilliant that it's brilliantly explained. It makes so much sense. And, you know, I noticed these things while I watched the series Doctor Who, but I couldn't put my finger on it. I didn't know what was wrong. It just felt weird, like the whole River Song thing. I was so confused by it. And
I just thought I was supposed to be confused. The problem is when you then go back and try and map out her timeline, it doesn't work. That's sort of the where it falls down.
Yeah.
I really like being confused by it, but then, yeah.
I think the problem is Moffat wants to make it really... Maybe this is also... Maybe I'm taking this in my memory from the video. But I think the problem is Moffat tries to be really, you know, he tries to make it really complicated and he tries to impress all the people, but it's just not quite good enough to make it work out.
Maybe it doesn't have to make sense.
That has always been the saving grace of Doctor Who, because Doctor Who had never had a strict canon. But of course, you can always say, "Oh, time travel and alternate dimensions, everything can happen."
But there used to be rules for Doctor Who.
It was never consistent. That's if you look.
The first couple of new seasons were quite consistent for.
Possibly.
And then they started breaking them with the Moffats.
Well. I would contest that.
I don't think it has to be entirely logical.
No, of course not. That's just a fun thing to try out for incredible nerds to try out and piece together. But yeah, mm-hmm. of course it's... Especially like, what's his face? Russell T. Davies from the first 3-4 series. He was always about the sort of emotional payoff before the clever time travel stuff, mm-hmm. which I think I usually preferred.
Me too. I also preferred Russell T. Davies' script writing. All right, I think we've
done enough about Doctor Who.
Yeah, we've gone quite far away from anything that's vaguely... Well, it is. We're still talking about writing and the ins and outs of writing. So, is there any place where the people can find you on the internet?
Oh, not really. I have a Twitter, which I rarely use, which is @JustATody. There you go.
You're not going to plug your blog again?
It's already been mentioned so many times, but I think I've advertised it enough for a while.
Mm. Okay.
I'm on Twitter @...
Should we have asked you, sorry?
No, I can ask myself. I'm a big boy. I can ask myself.
You are a big boy.
I'm @ Leo Engelmeyer on Twitter. This was episode 16 of the Universe podcast. If you enjoyed it and would like to hear more of us, make sure to subscribe to the Universe podcast wherever you're listening to it. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review to tell us what you think and help other people find the podcast. And tell all your friends about it. Comments? Questions? You can reach us on Twitter. We're @ PodUniverse. On Facebook, or on our email address, podcast@universe.univ.org. This podcast was edited and hosted by Leonhard Engelmeyer. The co-host was Charlotte Zerz. Our guest of this episode was Andreas Lausberger. On the editorial board for this episode was Charlotte Zerz, and me, of course. I hope you visit this planet in the universe again. In the meantime, stay safe in space. Thanks for listening.